a reality show from space. Yes, it's real. And today I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to introduce you guys to the team behind your new favorite web series today on the Fly Filmmaking.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
Hey everyone, Mary Lou Mandel here, and we're really dramatic. We're really, really dramatic today, talking about Personal Space, a web series that's a reality show from space. The first reality show from space.
Yeah.
I love it. So I've got Tom Pike, Dana Lurie-Shaw? How do you say the middle name?
Lori.
Like L-O-R-I.
Yes, but spelled poorly.
Like a British truck.
L-U-E-R-Y.
Correct.
L-U-E-R-Y. Dana Lurie-Shaw and Jeff Hammer, the team behind Personal Space. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, and I think maybe the most guests we've had all at once on this show. I've had two. Now we've got three people. Full panel. It's very exciting. It's like we're really, really using up all of my personal space.
Well, the key difference is that we know this is being broadcast.
Yes.
So.
Awesome.
That's a big plus.
Yes, we're saying hi to Dana's mom.
Hi, Mom. I'm sorry I didn't send you the link directly. I hope you can find this.
Yeah, well, fortunately, this show will be up on the internet in perpetuity. So, Tom, let everybody know where they can find you on social media.
You can find me on Twitter at StoryTom, the word story followed by my first name.
Nice. And Dana?
I am the fake Dana. I am just a really good duplicate.
Yeah, I love it. On Twitter, the fake Dana. And then Tom, or Jeff, on Instagram.
Yeah, at El Jefe Martillo.
Which is, Martillo is hammer in Spanish. So si. He's like the boss hammer. It's very, very exciting. That's like a really, really impressive gangster name. So I like that. So they have produced a wonderful web series that you can watch on Amazon and also Share TV. Mm-hmm, is that the other place that you can watch it? And the first season is out. It's super wonderful, really fun to watch. And you've got a really awesome actor in there. You've got a great cast, but your star here is from Battlestar Galactica, Captain Apollo. Richard Hatch.
Yeah, Richard was on both versions of Battlestar Galactica. Mm-hmm. He started out in the very first one in the 70s, and when the new one was coming out in 2003, he and some of the other cast had some... they were like, well, it's never going to be as good, and then Ronald D. Moore offered him a part, and he changed his tune.
Yeah.
So he was the only actor to appear in both versions of it. When he passed away last year... one of his obituaries described him as the man who knew more than anyone else alive about humanity's war against the Cylons.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He really, really did. Yeah. And then this was his last project.
Yes. He had a number of... Well, there's a lot of things you could call his last project. This is one of his last projects.
One of his last projects. Okay.
He was shooting three different things when he shot Personal Space. So he came from another set. The next day he was on our set. The next day he was on someone else's set. And he just never slowed down.
Yeah.
This would have been in September of 2016, and he passed away in February of 2017. He was doing his own stunts and working constantly, and not just working, like an actor at his level, right, can phone it in. They can take the part, they mm-hmm. can show up, they can say their lines, and they can go home. And he would workshop it. I mean, he was taking these goofy scripts we'd written with these dumb jokes, and he was treating it like it was Shakespeare.
Yeah.
So he would work all day and then show up the next day on the next thing and then go home at night and immerse himself in these scripts. His work ethic was just incredible. So, yes, this is...
Yeah. Yeah,
among his final projects.
How wonderful that you were able to get him on this. And you could see in the episodes that he really is taking this seriously. And you mentioning that he was working up until his death, like that's something about filmmaking that I've heard about a lot. That like people do this until you really can't anymore because it's so wonderful and people love it. Like it's hard work. You put a lot of time in, but I've heard this story so many times. People are like, oh yeah, like he was working like a month ago.
Yeah. I think partly it was he died of pancreatic cancer, which is very sudden. But there, you know, I'm not sure when he knew, you mm-hmm. know, because I suspect he knew when he shot in September. We don't. No one's really sure because he was very private about that. And I respect that. But I think that he didn't want anyone to think he was sick because he wanted to continue to work.
Yeah.
And he wanted to continue and he wanted us to think that he could do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we had him up on wires pretending to be floating in zero gravity, and he didn't he didn't want it to be known that he was in discomfort. Yeah. He's an actor, so he can convince you. You mm-hmm. sort of, then as the director, you have to know, like, all right, I've put a 71-year-old up on in a harness for enough time today, maybe.
Yeah.
But he would have just like, kept
you have
doing
to be
it.
The one to tell.
Yeah,
off.
Exactly. You have to tell him when to stop working.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Well, let's take a look at the trailer that you guys have with Richard in it. And check out this show that you guys have put together. Really wonderful.
I'm just thinking that it may be necessary for me to step in to help her keep everyone on her side.
Why do you think she needs to be helped?
Well, obviously, I've never felt this way, but back on Earth, some said that Gail's only on this mission because of who her parents are, what they did. People talk.
I can tell you about this because you're the commander.
Gail's only on this mission because of who her parents are.
My parents?
Yeah, if she continues to botch easy mediation, I worry that her crew isn't going to respect her authority. So I'm happy to lend her some of mine.
So that's just a little snippet for you guys to check out of Personal Space, but definitely go on to Amazon. If you're Amazon Prime, then you can watch the first season.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Really fun to watch. And it's a comedy. So this one, the tone of it is serious but I wanted to show Richard Hatch in there, and he really was taking like these things very, very seriously.
Yeah. It is a dramedy, I would say. Mm-hmm. So, there's some episodes that are more focused on the comedy and some episodes that are more on the drama. Like I was saying before the interview, it's a show about very lonely people. They're out on this deep space mission, and they're only the only people they can talk to are the same four or five people over and over again. And if that's the person that annoyed them that week, then that's not really an option. And also their therapy computer. So the show is all them talking to the therapy computer, as you saw in the clip. And if the show was a pure drama, then it would have just been 2.5 hours of people being really sad.
Yeah.
I don't think that. So there are lighter moments. And I know that a lot of the actors, like Richard and Nikki Klein, who is also in the newer Battlestar Galactica.
You just saw
part
her.
Of the, oh, yeah, she was just in the
commander.
Clip. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the appeal for people like that is they don't get asked to do comedy all that often, but yeah. I think everybody secretly enjoys it.
Yeah, it's so, fun. Everybody likes to laugh. Awesome. So let's talk about how this project came to be. Mm-hmm. So you guys have worked together on a previous project and a few other things.
Mm-hmm.
So how did we get to Personal Space?
Go ahead and take this one. I've done a lot of talking.
Oh, okay. Well, Tom and I have been working together since college. We made a web series for a website called TV Tropes. And we worked on a number of other things together. And our collaborators have been numerous. And we got to a point where Tom wanted to really make a web series set in space. But we didn't have money to make a web series that could be set in space. So we set out to try and figure out how we could get around that problem. And that's kind of where the concept of a vlog-style show came from. And using a single set to tell this larger story, that's really the genesis of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've made a lot of scripts over many years that were cheap Star Wars, and that whenever you're trying to make Star Wars for $40,000, or we weren't even talking about that much money at the time,
$5,000 maybe.
It looks like you tried to make cheap Star Wars, right? And I'm sure there are people who that's what they want to do, and that's fine. For us, it was we would rather have done a few things really well than a lot of things really badly, or a lot of things okay. So like we have a single set that you see that's on the ship, and we could focus our limited funds on making that set look good. And we have a small cast, but we can focus on getting really good actors. And really work on the scripts and make the scripts of this character study, right? And because we can't hide behind spaceship battles, we can't hide behind really expensive effects work. The character work has to be there. It has to be entered. You have to like these people. You have to want to spend time with them. You have to, and so the writing just has to be really, really good. So we had a lot of versions of a sci-fi web series that are nothing like what we ended up doing.
And that we'll never wind up making because they're too expensive.
And someone ended up with this one. So when you started this, like, you knew it wanted, you wanted it to be a web series because there's a lot of episodes.
Yes.
Yeah. How many are in this first season?
28.
28 episodes of then they're all about 5 minutes. So production wise, like, you aimed at making that many. So it was like the length of a, like, more than a movie.
Yeah. I mean, production wise, the page count, I mean, it was a lot of pages.
Yeah.
So it was like 190 pages was the first season. And so that's longer than any of the Lord of the Rings scripts. And so then it was just a matter of, all right, what's the most reasonable way to shoot this with the money that we don't have? and because, again, it's all theoretical until you actually, you know, raise the money. So then it was just a matter of, okay, how can we do this as efficiently as possible? And even before I came on board, they understood that it's like bring in one actor at a time because of the style of the show and how it's shot. And then you just do most of their footage in 2 days. And with most of the principal cast, that's exactly what it was. Like, you know, they did 2 days. That was most of their footage. And then any scenes that required them to be together, then we just had to fit pieces together in that manner.
I think we shot for, what, 11 days?
11 days.
11 days total,
So while one of them was a practice for the special effects, and one was a special effects, or not special effects, but...
Stunt
day. So we had really 9 days that we were working with 190-some pages, which is... I'm not going to be able to do the math on the fly right now, but maybe 11 pages. Like, no, not 11. I'm sorry. More 21 like 21 pages a day.
Yeah.
So that's that was our rate.
We're moving and shaking.
Well,
a lot of those actors also, like Nikki and Richard, of course, and Kurt Yeager, who's on Sons of Anarchy and NCIS and a bunch of other shows, and Cliff Simon, who was on Stargate. Tim Russ was on Voyager. But these people are coming in from the TV format where they're doing a few scenes a day. And we're rolling them through that many pages, and we got to get it all. It was a lot of work for them, a lot of work memorizing the lines before they get on set. They all did their homework. I was really, really impressed with that, how much work they did. And then when they got to the set, like if I'm me and I'm sitting in the chair and the camera's right there, then we have a prompter to the side of it, but they didn't typically look at it all that much. The prompter was mostly used before a take to remind themselves what the heck was going on.
Right.
Because, like, we would wrap up one shot, and then it might jump forward 2 episodes before their next scene, and they'd be like, okay, what's going on? And we would talk through it. Here's what happened. Here's who annoyed you this week. Here's what you're trying to do about it.
Right.
And then, so, like, as a director, I had to be the glue that kept the story together because there was so much that the actors had to do. And they really rose to the occasion.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so I want to talk to you guys about casting then. You've got such a stellar cast of very experienced actors. How was that process? How did you get to the point where you were getting these, you know, sci-fi TV show alumni?
I love this part.
It's just dominoes.
that's exactly right. We had planned, as Dana alluded to shoot this in a closet in front of a cardboard set, and we were happy with that plan. Like, we were going to get to make our space show, we held auditions, and we realized that I realized that I was having trouble narrowing down some of the roles because, like,
particularly
I always,
the role of Commander Gail Gardner,
the lead,
who is played by Nikki Klein now.
Yeah, so I had every time I write a character for screen, I like to picture someone in my head. I used to think it was an indulgence, but the point as a writer is it gets someone else's voice in your head other than your own, so it helps distinguish the characters, which is nice. I'd always pictured Nikki as Gail Gardner. Needed someone who was sympathetic and charming, someone you really want to root for. But I had no idea I had no way to reach her or anything, and I just couldn't bring myself to make an offer based on the auditions. And I realized the reason was because I'd never even tried to reach out to her. And then we reached out to her, and then she said yes.
How'd you reach out to her? Through founder agent? Through Twitter? Through,
yeah,
knocked on her door?
This is bad. What happened? Don't do this. Don't do this.
Not
this
that
is,
professional.
Yeah, no. The truth is I used to do background checks, and I'm pretty good at finding people's contact information.
Scandal!
So,
but you got it done. Sure.
I
got it
done. No, so like I went to her, and I understand why she said yes. Like I went to her, and I said, we wrote this part picturing you. You'd be our first choice. This is a female-led science fiction dramedy, and you're the commander. And I mean, I think it just happened to be what she was looking for at that time. And once she signed on, it opened the door. We'd gotten in touch with Tim Russ, who was acquainted with one of our writers, and we had those two people that had agreed to be on the show, and the whole world changed. Because now you're not shooting that in the closet.
Yeah.
You're not doing that. Like you have to rent a studio. You have to do it properly.
To be fair, it still would have been interesting if they did it in a closet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they probably wouldn't be
so. I think we would have been embarrassed. Yeah. So.
True. Yeah, it was more about how willing are they to come back for season two? So.
Yeah, I've definitely found on like other web series that I've worked production on, when they do get some named talent, I've just noticed everybody's game. Like, people mm-hmm. just want to work on cool stuff.
Yeah, that's the truth of it, isn't it? And these people act. This is the real lesson. Really don't do what I did with reaching out. But the lesson, I think, to learn from it is, like, I'm not from L.A., and I think of someone, if they've been on TV and they had, like, a really memorable role, something I loved, I grew up watching, then I sort of picture them in some villa in the Hollywood Hills. You know, like, they're successful. They made it. They had a big party. There was a banner that says, "You made it."
Yeah.
And then they live there now, and they're successful forever. And the truth is, they got to pay the rent the next month.
A villa's a very expensive place to live.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So there is nothing untouchable about good talent. They want to do good work. And if you really work on the script, like, our pilot had gone through 25 revisions, I think, before we even showed it to Tim. And it wasn't even done at that point. But they want to perform. That's why they're actors.
Yeah.
And so you've nothing to lose by asking. There were plenty of people turned down roles. I mean, that happens. We got a lot of our first choices, but we made a list of, like, 100 people that were, like, I can see this person doing the show.
Yeah.
And then you just go, you rank them, and you go through them, and you try to get them.
Love that. You aimed for your target character, like target performer for mm-hmm. this character, and you happened to get it.
Yeah.
You know, because you tried. Because, like, mm-hmm. if you just didn't ask, you definitely would have gotten a no.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But
at the end of the day, actors want to act.
Yeah.
And if they like the project, if they like the writing, most of the time they're going to be game as long as they're available like with their schedule, even if it's, you know, a low budget show, especially in LA, because so many of them are here. If you can just have something where they can sleep in their own bed at night,
great. They're just like, awesome, cool.
Yeah. And also the way we were shooting it, where they're coming in and they're doing their stuff and then they're going home, and then they might have a day where they do a few scenes, but most people were only on set for 2, maybe 3 days. Nikki was an exception. She was there, I think, 5 days, and Richard was on set a fair amount too, but most people were there 1 to 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a small commitment of their time. Like, basically, what we were offering them was, you're going to be on screen for, like, an hour to an hour and a half. You're going to be on set for, like, a day. There was very little downside to saying, sure, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And I think as long as you're asking yourself, what can I do to make this project attractive from an actor's perspective, then you can get a fair amount of the talent that you might hope for, and then everything else becomes easier. Because once we had those two actors, like Jeff said, it was dominoes. Mm-hmm. The other actors would see we had those people involved,
mm-hmm.
and that was a mark of our seriousness. And then they would read the script. It didn't mean that they would sign up right away, but they would read the script and actually consider it. So it opened doors.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, so then talk to me about scaling from being in a closet to, like, a legit set that you guys built.
That's on Jeff, I think. That was his problem.
Yeah, because, well, like you were saying, like, now you've got all these actors, and you're like, well, be embarrassed if we're just like, go sit in this closet and talk to me, like, YouTube style.
Right, yeah. So I came on board later, and so it was the first season script was already, you know, completed, and I think there was only one or two more revisions. And when I read it, I was like, okay, I don't see a whole lot here that I would even give notes on. Like, my background is still writing, and mm-hmm. I teach screenwriting at USC, and so I'm going through this always like with a really critical eye, and I'm like, oh, this is good.
Yeah.
This is going to work. And then I also had just come off of a movie that I did that I produced, and it was kind of a learn-by-doing process of, like, making my own thing. And so I had a good idea of what I was going to take production-wise, and that was something also low-budget, but we jumped around a bunch of different locations. Like, I had to work around some restaurants, like, you know, hours, so on and so, you know, we had motorcycles, gunfire, and I looked at this, I'm like, we could shoot this all on a stage and just keep this so simple. And because of the conceit of the vast majority of the show coming from Amy's point of view, and Amy is the ship's therapy computer, so much time is chewed up in production on like moving lights around and just moving equipment. And so if you can build like one set and then set the lights up the day before, and then you're literally just flicking them on and off, and it saves so much time. And then that made me start to realize, like, no, we could really pull this off. And then it's just a matter of, okay, how good is the spaceship going to look? And I, you know, with this, like, there were some very clear ideas that came in. And, like, sometimes you just come in on faith. And I had faith that it was going to look good. And then it was just a matter of just making, I guess, prudent decisions. Like, you know, the non-sexy part of filmmaking is like, okay, this is how much money we have. This is the crew that I can get. These are the rates that we can do. And we're going to have to be shortchanged here. We'll be shortchanged here, but we can make it up here. Limit the production days as much as possible. And then it's like, okay. Then it just went to Andrew, who was our production designer, and said, what do you need? Like, here are, you know, the ideas. Like, Tom and Zach, like, you know, went over a lot of, like, you know, the details with him. Like, we have an idea of how we're going to do the props, and we're going to give you a lot of support, and we just need you to build it and make it, you know, look good. And so then it was a matter of finding another spaceship set that was used on a short film, and we just took all of it and only used, like, you know, one piece of it and just retrofitted it for our needs. Mm-hmm. And once we had it built, and once...
How very green of you.
Yeah. I mean, it was the day before... we started filming when I, not that I had a bad feeling, but you just never know like how it's going to be.
It's going to work.
Yeah. But it's like when I saw the set done and I saw, the actors like, you know, came in for some fittings and saw them in like some of their uniforms. I'm like, okay, we've got a chance here. Like, you know, we've got a chance to make something, you know, good. And now let's just hope that the production goes smoothly. And I mean, there was one major snafu in between the two times that we shot, because we shot in July and then September due to actor availability. And so it was just like juggling a whole bunch of different people's schedules and trying to make that work, you know, with all of this. And
that's the flip side of working with people who are bigger than you are and not having the budget to pay them $1 million, you know, is if they're like, this is when I'm free, you're like,
okay,
that's fine. That's 3 days before my wedding, but we'll make it work.
Yeah.
So that we had to split the shoot into July.
That was a real story, by the way.
That sounds real.
That's what we did. It was 3 days before our wedding.
So it was just like there was just a lot of like, you know, moving pieces around, and then once we, you know, figured the right schedule, and once it worked with everyone's lost my train of thought. Once we got everyone's schedules straightened out, like, you know, actor-wise, and once we had our crew set up and we just had it, like, you know, ready to go, then it was just a matter of, like, giving it a push. And fortunately, Tom and Dana were both very prepared. Like, everyone on the crew was, like, you know, prepared, and it was pretty smooth sailing. And so it was one of those things, like, knock on wood, where it's like, okay, it's going really well. Like, I don't even want to say anything because something's going to happen.
We ended every day early. We ended every single day of shooting early.
Yeah. For anyone who, like, has production background, like, we never went over 9.5 hours.
What?
Most of our days...
Never.
Yeah, most of our days were brought in under 8.
Wow.
Closest we came to running over, I think we ended 11 minutes early.
That's impressive.
That was a bad thing. Well, it was because the quality of the plan going up, which I attribute to Jeff scheduling, there was always padding for things to go wrong, and mm-hmm. things always did go wrong, especially mm-hmm. earlier on. We had one day where one of our lights hadn't been turned on again after lunch, And you've seen the clips from the show, so like it is all from that one angle. If there's a light that is turned off for some of the scenes,
doesn't look the same, yeah.
You'll notice. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't even have to be a gaffer to see that difference, and you can't really fix that in post. So stuff like that, we had to go back.
That was our longest. And then, ironically, that was also our heaviest page count day. I still remember. Kurt did 23 and 3/8 pages on that day.
And then did them again.
and he had to do some of them over. I mean, so just the amount of dialogue coming out of his mouth that day was pretty impressive. And, like, you know, nailing the lines, you know, and it's just, I can only imagine because it's just him with him. You know, the computer, and then he's like, sorry, we screwed up. You have to, like, redo a bunch of this stuff.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it was quicker the second time because he had he'd already gotten the performance down, mm-hmm. so we were just getting, like, the first take and the safety rather than going back and then
really working through all of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, how did you come up with the idea for this concept of, like, a reality show in space?
Yeah, it came out of the... that was me and Zach Waldow and Dana, and Zach and Dana and I had... The three of us had made the web series together, like, right when we were graduating college that got us sort of started on this whole trajectory. The origin came from just wanting to do something in space, but not wanting to do something that was cheap. So over the course of those many years, the challenge was to come up with something that would work well within constraints. Mm-hmm. Because, like, if you have... I think a lot of... Myself, as a writer, when I started writing, I really, really did not like constraints. I wanted to be able to write whatever. But I would say
most people start like that. Mm-hmm. You know, like most people that I talk to that are starting their project, they're like, I've got this idea, but there's like helicopters and explosions, and they're like, I need Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I'm just like, well, cool.
Start
or like
small.
Maybe like save that one.
Yeah.
And like start, do something else.
Yeah. And how bad would it be if you really do need those things and you try to make it anyway without them?
Yeah. That's kind of wasted it.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas, so the idea of doing it as the confessional, I mean, it comes more from literary web series than science fiction. There are not a whole lot of science fiction shows that do this kind of thing. Europa Report did a little bit of it, but they had many cameras through that.
I guess it depends on if you count Lonely Girl 15 as science fiction.
Yeah. Well, I do, but not in space.
Right, of course.
So it has been tried. But to do so much of it, to do 28 episodes and to format the episodes as 5-minute episodes, because of the way an attention span works in a vlog style format, that came from things like the Lizzie Bennet Diaries, which, you know, all of those Pemberley shows, they were massively successful in what they did. And we looked at what they did and you know, they have more episodes than we do. How many episodes of Lizzie
Bennet did 100 main episodes as well as maybe 20 some other ones.
So by the standards...
I worked on it, so I should know this, but I don't.
All right.
By the standards of a vlog-style show, 28 episodes is actually quite modest. It is a lot for a science fiction show, though. So we were drawing from both disciplines, using the storytelling techniques of a vlog-style show and the trappings of science fiction.
Right. Which I thought was really clever. But then I was curious why you spun it to be a reality show.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, you could have just made the story just from, like, just vlog style from the point of Amy and then cut it together in a way that we understand it. But putting it in the frame of the actual reality show, like, the people on Earth are watching.
Yeah, I think that's my hang-up.
Yeah?
I think I'm like, whenever I see something, I'm sort of like, I ask myself, but why are we seeing this? Or is this more interesting to see... in world, like in the world of personal space, these episodes are being broadcast on Earth, and we are watching the reality show that exists in this fictional world. It's sort of, it's like a wink and a nod as if we exist in the same world as them. And because that was something that I wanted to play with, there had also been then we can draw from all these things that are really happening or were really proposed. And one of them was this. Mission called Mars One. And Mars One, as far as I know, didn't actually end up... I mean, I think it's kind of dead in the water, but the idea was they would raise some money on crowdfunding, and they did. Not enough to actually go to Mars. $1 million, which is nothing in space money terms. So they were like, well, we're going to bridge the gap with a reality show on the ship, which is very inventive, but has a few problems. The biggest of which being, like, leaving aside whether you could actually make enough money on a reality show... A reality show, the incentive is to create drama. And on a space mission, they talk to any astronaut. They specifically pick people who aren't going to cause drama.
Yes.
It's the opposite goal. And, I mean, you're locked in a tin can with people and a small number of people. And, I mean, even on the ISS, they have mandatory sessions with psychologists. But they, there's no time delay. So, they don't have to, it doesn't have to be a computer. They just call someone on Earth. But, anyway, the psychological health of astronauts is incredibly, incredibly important. So you would never want to do this, I think.
Yeah.
And when I heard about that, I was just so intrigued. But it sounded so, I mean, it's like the Truman Show. It's mm-hmm. it's perverse and fascinating, and So we drew from a real thing that was actually proposed.
Oh, that's interesting. And you also had real NASA like consultants, right?
Yeah.
We'll call them that.
Yeah.
Oh, they're, okay.
They're, it was. It was I mean, very they are truly, unofficial.
But they really are. Or they're yes. not. Yeah.
No, they are. I just I have to be careful to clarify. I didn't pay them money because sometimes people have. Like, they can't do outside work.
They're related to you.
Yes.
Right? Yes. So yes, you have relatives that work for NASA that gave you some information. It's totally fine. That's yes. great. Get all the information. He just breaks into background checks. Like, he does what he needs. He's like, you are my brother. You will tell me about NASA.
So my brother is a subcontractor for NASA. He works on cryogenics, which he wants me to be very clear is not the same thing as cryonics. But like everybody
cryonics,
gets it confused.
By the way, yeah. is what our one character, mm-hmm. Stanley Blazkowicz, is trained in. So that's uh-huh. cryonics is like freezing people so that they can be woken up later,
okay.
which is how it works on the ship. Cryogenics is just the art of freezing things.
Yeah, basically.
Basically, oh, so like not
freeze
people.
Your fat. that's like the old trend on all the billboards in LA right now. Freeze your fat. Is that the same thing?
I think he works
thing?
On superconductors, actually.
Okay.
So,
all right.
He told me the story. This is not really relevant, but it's a fun story. To give you a picture of what he does, they had made this like Venus simulation chamber,
mm-hmm.
And he contributed to something on the electrical component side of it. And they had this open house, and people would come in and see this. And a Venus simulation chamber is a very high pressure, very, very hot. Fish tank shaped thing, and people would look at it and be like, how long does that take to cook a turkey? And everybody thought they were the first person to ask that question.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's what my brother does. My sister is an astronomer, so she didn't work for NASA. She works for observatories, and she studies the Kuiper Belt specifically, which is an icy bunch of objects out in the outer reaches of the solar system. And our protagonist, Gail Gartner, Nikki's character, is a female astronomer in her early 30s, like my sister, who studies the Oort cloud. Which
so
is
you've got like one sibling mm-hmm. that is a subcontractor for NASA. You've mm-hmm. got one sibling that studies space stuff.
Yeah.
And then one sibling that writes about space stuff.
My, my
and
dad
his father.
Is,
that's
yeah,
you.
Dad is
Tom,
you.
That's
oh,
she's talking about you.
You are that guy.
Yes. No, I'm the low achiever, yes.
no, it's like, I love that it's like a family thing. I don't think that's low achievement.
Yeah,
that's like awesome.
Yeah. And my dad plotted satellite trajectories for NASA. Uh-huh. In the 80s and left that to be with my mom.
Yeah.
So that's a true love story.
Because
I think that job sounds pretty sweet.
Yeah.
So we had free consultants that were great. And I mean, science on the show is science fiction. There are leaps that are taken, but we tried to ground it a lot in reality. And the most helpful thing that, as far as that was my sister, because she performs such a similar task to Nikki's character, she wrote up like this 10-page paper on how she would go about doing the search from the perspective of a moving ship, which is actually a very different challenge from doing it on Earth.
Oh,
and exactly. I would never have thought about that.
Yeah.
I would never have thought about that at all. And she was defending her dissertation at the time. So I have and she talked, like Nikki called her and they talked about it, and they talked about like the culture of what it's like to do that kind of work, and it was just a tremendous resource to have. And I think the lesson to take away there is
have great family.
Look at what you have. Look at what you have access to, and find a way to use that. Because when you list all the stuff we had going for us, it sounds really impressive. But
yeah.
that's because we lined it all up in a row, so mm-hmm. it helped us. If we tried to do any number of other things, it just wouldn't have come together like this.
Yeah. So. No, I agree with that. I have like a lot of people are like, I want to create something, but I don't know what to create. I'm like, well, what's already in your world?
Yeah.
Like, don't try to like make Lord of the Rings right now. You know, like what's in your world? Are you a dad? Do a dad show. Like
it's like mariachi filmmaking. Mm-hmm. So like how Robert Rodriguez made El Mariachi. It's just, yeah. It's the philosophy of like, write for what you have, not for what you want.
Yes.
Like, you know, until you have more means, and then resources. You can expand your canvas. Otherwise, just
then you're still writing what you
stay
have.
In your lane and know exactly what you can do, and you can do it really well, as opposed to being a little too ambitious or a lot too ambitious and just crashing and burning miserably.
Right, because that's exactly the like the person who wants to make the explosions and the helicopters, but then they try to make it and it's really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's like wasteful. But you could have made a really good like I don't know
personal story.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's good. And then I really loved like the pairing down to a single location.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically you guys had two locations. You had like the people who were on the backdrop announcing the show.
Yeah, so there's the reality announcers back on Earth. But that was a very simple setup. I wouldn't even, it'd be generous to call it a set.
Yeah,
you know, it's like a photo shoot style backdrop.
Yeah, I mean, technically like we had four setups. I mean, with some supporting characters who have like one scene each.
Yeah.
But it was all in the same studio, and literally we had the set set up, and then we would walk 20 feet, and then walk 15 feet, and then when Kat was on set, it was just like, we're just going to go in the corner, we'll set up a podium, and this will be perfect.
Yeah, and that's something that I discuss with like my social media audience when they're asking about like, how can I get to actually producing things. I'm like, well, remove obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
If you can pare it down and make it a set where you turn on a light and you turn on the camera and you go as much as possible, then explore other things. But like when you're beginning, if you figure out a story that you can just do in one set, you know, like this, like look at us, we're like here, we can talk for an hour and have a show. You know, see, cute. It's cute. Thank
you. The bare minimum of making a story is having a story.
Mm-hmm.
And once you have that, you're good to go. And certain stories require certain things that other ones don't. But the bare minimum is really good writing and performers who can bring it to life.
Yeah.
And so for us, it was a process of determining, aside from those two things, what else do we absolutely need?
Mm-hmm.
Because we just didn't have the money to spend it on stuff that we wanted. And in the writing process, we knew we had... we knew we wanted one episode that was visually really striking, that showed off some technical capabilities that we didn't use in other episodes. So we had one episode with stunt work.
Mm-hmm.
That episode was about 3.5 minutes long out of our 2.5 hour runtime. We spent 2 full days on it. And because we had to pay the stunt coordinators, it ended up being, I don't know what the exact portion
is. It was about 10% of the budget.
Yeah.
And
on this little segment.
Yeah.
Well, did you find it was worth it?
That was because we were like, there's one thing we get to do, one thing. What is the best story payoff for going all out on one episode?
Right. It's like when you're going on vacation on a budget and you're like, all right, I can do one fancy thing.
And the rest of the time we're going camping.
Yep.
And that's, that's exactly right. That's a really good comparison. I love that.
Yeah. Cool. So let's talk about how you guys actually got to this point in your career. So, did you go to film school?
I did.
Yeah. And then, what did you go for writing, for screenwriting?
I did.
Yeah?
Yeah. So I did my MFA at USC and then came out into the freelance world. And, like, just about everyone who comes out in the freelance world had to work another job for, some years. And so I'd, like, be working during the day. And then whenever I had meetings, I'd take them, like, you know, after 4 o'clock and then have some night meetings, you know, that are mostly, like, you know, meet and greets or just, like, you know, hey, let's grab a drink or let's get coffee or whatever. And so, like, you know, knocked around a lot of time, you know, as a writer with some successes, you know, more punches in the face. and then just decided to make, you know, my own movie. And I did, and because I produced it and I, you know, got to see it to the finish line and knew who to do that. Dana and I, like one of these meetings, like we were in a writing fellowship together about a year before that. And after it ended, I was heavy into pre-production and then just, you know, make my movie. And then right after I got, you know, done and I picture locked it, just we got together for a drink. She started talking to me because you're just like, hey, what are you doing? You know? And she started telling me about the show. And then I was like, that sounds really interesting. And then I had a whole bunch of like my producer brain kind of like flipped on. I just asked her a bunch of questions and she's like, I'm going to call Tom and
and make him come out to this bar.
I was in my pajamas. I was at home. I was having a nice night off and she makes me come out and work.
And now you have a series.
Yeah. Well, and from our perspective, Dana.
I'm a jerk.
Jeff finished a feature. Like, I cannot stress how challenging that. I have never done that.
Yeah.
Dana has never done that. That is, there are so many different times a project can die.
Mm-hmm.
There are probably 8 or 9 times personal space almost died.
Yeah, like these projects, it's like the most fragile baby mm-hmm. ever.
Yeah.
And at any point, it can mm-hmm. just be like, no.
Yeah, it can die when you're writing it. It can die when you're casting it. It can die, even if there's no gatekeeper shutting you out, there's mm-hmm. still so many ways it can die. It can die during production so easily. And that was this is neither here nor there. The point is the fact that he had actually finished this feature mm-hmm. and that it resembled what he had tried to do when he set out to make it was very impressive. It spoke to a skill set that I'm frankly not the most organized guy. I would never have been able to complete production on the scale that we did without help.
Jeff happened to approach us at the exact yeah. moment that, like, earlier that week, we turned to each other and said, we really should, like, get a producer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, in comes Jeff.
Yeah, so then for you, how is producing versus writing?
I really like both of them. They're totally different.
Yeah.
For me, it always comes down, like, I really like production. I like being on set. Like, you know, I've directed before, and so... when I produce, I just try to think of, okay, this is what I would really like as a director. How can I do this and do it in a way where a lot of times they don't even have to think about it? And then how can I, if I have to tell them no? So there was an episode where we were going to have, like, you know, a spacesuit. And you can't go cheap on the spacesuit. We got a space show. And it's just way too expensive. And so I was just kind of like, all right, we can't do this. And this is how we need to, like, you know, pivot on this. And you can still get what you want as a director and then, like, give, you know, some options. And then he's like, oh, okay, well, yeah, we can do that one. We'll just do that as a visual effect, you know, so on and so forth. But it's many different fires, like, you know, at many, you know, different times. Because, you know, there's the prep. And, you know, and this was, like, small enough where I did, like, you know, UPM and Line, you know, producing and, like, essentially, like, first AD, because I put together the whole schedule
mm-hmm.
and I just hired an AD for, like, actual production so that they could just, like, kind of
to
run the shit.
For you. Yeah.
And so I really like the efficiency that can come with producing. It's like I've got a very strong science background as well, like, not astronomy, but so it was very similar to, like, you know, preparing for a lab, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of ways is, like, you know, how producing is. And then every experiment's different, and you just try to do it as well as you can. This one, logistically, there was a lot of things that were fairly simple. Staying in one location, like, I can't stress that enough. Even if just moving equipment out and putting it on a truck and then unloading it, like, it's like we just eliminated, you know, all of that. So it was, like, you know, cool on this. But writing, I really like, but it's totally different muscles. It's just like, you know... it's like you start with a blank page and then you have to create, you know, from nothing. And
yeah.
So it's really fun. Like on season 2, we have a rough draft, you know, it still needs to be developed, but it's been really fun to be like on the writing side of it now that, because I just didn't meet them soon enough to be in there for the first season. So now it's like, you know, really, like to me, that would be like the best thing is like, you know, writing something and then like, you know, producing it and
right.
like, you know, having a hand of like steering the ship and having creative contributions. But also, I hate when someone's looking over my shoulder when, like, I'm directing. So I just kind of, like, just step back and just let the person that, you know, who's in charge of that job, like, do their job.
Yeah, let them do their job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think there's a few things that Jeff has reminded me of that I think are really important to note. One is, you know, he is writing on season 2. And it's important on projects that are small like this. Because you can't really pay anyone what they're worth. And this project took 3.5 years to make
mm-hmm.
from start to finish. That is almost as long as most people spend in undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a huge commitment of time for the people who are making it. And you have to give them something more than money.
Your
which
loyalty.
Is, yeah. Loyalty and, like, we'll get you work when we can, but also some kind of creative input into the show.
Mm-hmm.
It is a collaboration. You cannot make a cheap film with an auteur mentality. I really actually dislike the auteur mentality in general.
Yeah, and I've even got that from the filmmakers who are on bigger sets that, mm-hmm. you know, like, you're not going to give, like, everybody creative, like, mm-hmm. you know, input. But to ask somebody, like, this is kind of what I'm seeing, but what do you think?
Yeah, and they can tell
and
you
no. And they get a little bit of ownership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they feel a little bit more involved in the project, and, like, even though you're, like, you can't mm-hmm. pay them what they're worth, but they're like, no, but, like, I belong. I'm part yeah. of this team.
And, like, if your gaffer tells you, I don't think we should light it that way. Mm-hmm. You don't have to agree with them, but you should absolutely hear them out. Mm-hmm. You paid that person because they know more about this thing than
right?
you do.
Right, because of their specialty.
Exactly.
Totally.
So everybody that comes in, you gotta know that they're giving you their time, and that's very generous, and you have to respect it. And mm-hmm. the, like the actors, it is a process of crafting the character in collaboration with the writer and the director, and it's important to let them have a voice in who the character becomes, too. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
Yeah.
Cool. That's a whole thing.
So, Dana, I want to ask you, how many other females were on your production crew?
Let's see. I believe we got about parity, right?
It felt that way, but it was more like 40%.
Oh, I guess
the
I'm
writing
thinking,
room was 50.
Writing room is about half and half.
It's exactly half and half.
Nice. Yeah.
How many writers did you have?
Six for season yes. one? Okay. Yeah. So it was half and a half there.
And six on season two, half mm-hmm. and half.
Yes.
Nice.
Let's see. So yeah, I guess 40% on
that's very
set.
Good.
Yeah.
That's very, very good. Because like I've worked on tons of sets where I am the only girl.
It was very important mm-hmm. to us to not have that be the
yeah.
case at any point.
Yeah, which is good. So you made a conscious effort to seek that out, or that just happened to be the people that you know and work with?
Well, it's a female-led show, mm-hmm. and it's in part about the struggles of being a woman when there is a man who is trying to
yeah.
tell you how to do your job and not letting you do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. So it kind of really wouldn't work properly if we didn't have women telling that
totally.
Story.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's really good. That's why I was like thinking that. I was like, they must have had more females on crew in writing specifically.
Yeah.
Because of the way that the story was. And I was like, okay, I feel like, because I know this struggle.
Yes.
I know that. I was like, mm-hmm, sit down, Richard.
Yeah, actually, I feel like the bigger risk with the story was making Richard's character not a total scumbag.
Yeah.
Right? Because it is something that so many women know and is being talked down to in that way. Like, he's got the same qualifications as her, but he doesn't think that she can do the job.
Right.
One of my favorite stories from set is that, so we had two actual shoots, one in July and one in September, and we had the same crew back, mostly, for the two shoots, and our sound guy, he came up to Tom in September and said, well, from the July shoot, when it was Richard, I thought Richard's side of the story was, like, he was the hero. And now that I've heard the other side, now that Nikki's come on and done her part, like, I'm not sure who to root for anymore. And we were like, good. That's
so cool.
Wonderful.
Yeah, because you could spend all day with these characters, and my job as a director would be to say, here's how you feel about this.
Mm-hmm.
And so on a given day, you would take the perspective of whoever was in that chair, which is actually a great exercise. Like, vlog style, for that reason, is a really good exercise for writers and directors to realize that you can't write villains who think they're the bad guy.
Yeah, because,
like,
the bad guys aren't. They don't know they're the bad guy.
Exactly.
They're the hero of their story.
Yeah, he thinks
absolutely.
He's trying to help her. He's just doing it in a really patronizing way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's much more honest about the way these things happen. So, anyway, that was a huge compliment. And also, sound guys don't have to, like, pay
they
attention.
They don't have to pay
care,
attention.
You know? Like, it was really neat that he cared.
You just, like, aim at the sound and make sure you catch it. But, yeah, that's great. That
I'm going to defend the soundies a little bit. They care.
They care.
I'm just saying, like,
they just don't have to.
They don't have to do,
all.
Like,
right.
deep thinking in their off hours about, like, the implications of, you know. Anyway.
So what did you guys do for any fundraising? Like, how did you raise your money?
That was mostly Kickstarter.
Yeah, okay.
So we knew once we cast the people that we cast that was going to be an uphill climb to get the kind of set that we needed, to get the kind of studio that we needed, and we budgeted out what we needed and then chopped off about $20,000 bucks,
mm-hmm.
and that hurt. And we went for it.
Yeah.
And Kickstarter is all or nothing, but I used to do crowdfunding consulting. I was just Dana crowdfunding consulting. Mm-hmm. And Jeff had done an Indiegogo.
I had done crowdfunding, but I didn't know how to do crowdfunding until like I watched them. Like, you know how to do it.
All right. Well, then tell our viewers, like, give them some tips for crowdfunding for their project.
So plan everything. Launch your social media pages well before
three months in advance, at least.
And invite everybody to like the Facebook.
Except your exes.
It's going to feel obnoxious. But I mean, actually, one of my exes gave to Personal Space. So I would invite your exes.
Invite your exes.
It's going to feel obnoxious, but it's only going to
get. As long as it's a.
Yeah.
I guess clean breakup.
Yeah. She's pretty cool. But when you're doing this, it's not a magic money bucket. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to put the page up. And people find it on their own and be like,
"Interesting. I shall get out my checkbook."
Yeah, it doesn't work. Yeah,
you're having to sell it. You have to go up there and market it on its own.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so if it's a 30-day campaign, you have 30 days worth of material that you're going to be posting, and you have like a set schedule that you're doing everything by.
Yeah.
And then, one of the things, like our first like work experience was we did like, four kind of related episodes called Science Marches Han, which is like Dr. Han, who appears like in the middle of the season.
Yeah.
Briefly in like one of the Earthside segments at the very end.
Yeah.
He's like a Bill Nye character.
Yeah, okay. Very much. Yeah. And so actor Tyler Ham Pong, like he was great. I hadn't even read the first season script yet when we did Science Marches Han. So I thought he was one of the main characters of the show.
Nope.
And not even realizing that. He's like, a supporting character who pops in, and then Sean, who's only in one episode, is like one of the leads. And so I didn't even see it at the time. I was like, oh, of course, these four episodes are the four scientific concepts that are applicable to the four crew members of the second shift. And so it just works as a perfect opportunity to drop them one a week, like during the campaign. And then Tom and Dana and Zach and a bunch of the actors, like, all filmed, like, videos. And, like, there's all this content that gets put out there. It's like, I'm preaching to the choir with these two. But it's like, I'm watching all this, like, and I hired crowdfunding consultants, and I didn't get any of this. Yeah, not you. So that's another, don't hire crowdfunding consultants. If
that
they
aren't us.
That aren't, yes, Tom and Dana.
I don't want to do it anymore, but it's so much work. Don't hire me.
But
I didn't even realize that was a thing.
Oh,
of course, there's a consultant for everything. There is. That's a really good resource.
If they ask for their money up front without any performances, run away.
No. I always charge a percentage, because then if I didn't succeed, then I get what I think is a fair share of the, which is also why I don't want to do it anymore, because sometimes it doesn't succeed. But
exactly.
Anyway, so like Jeff's point about you got to be coming out with content constantly is really important, because when you're crowdfunding, it's 30 days. And a lot of the days you're just sitting there staring at your computer. You better have something that you can fire away, because that maybe you're having a rough day. Someone you expected to give money turned you down, and you took it harder than you thought you would. And having something that you know you can post is really helpful. And also having something you can post where it's not just give me money again, 25th time I've asked. It's like, hey, here's what we can do. Here's this cool thing. Share this with me. It's an experience. You're selling an experience, not a product. Like, people give to crowdfunding campaigns because they want to feel like they're a part of having something succeed, which is why we always give away some kind of producer credit on crowdfunding campaigns at like $100 to $110 around there. Because people love being called a producer, and it costs you nothing. You put it in your credits, and then they, like, own a piece of it, and that's it.
The other thing that was really important for us with the Science Marches Han stuff is we were able to say, well, here's four episodes we made for $500.
It was like $2,000.
Whatever. It's small,
it was cheap.
way less money than we were asking for.
Cardboard set.
literal cardboard set.
In my garage, a park that I found nearby.
Right on.
And so it was, this is what we can do with $0, essentially. And it's still fun and entertaining, and it relates. Imagine what we can do with not $0. Imagine what we can do with $50,000 or $40,000.
Yeah, that's a good way of, like, putting it out there of, like, okay, so this is what we're making with nothing. Give me a little bit.
Yeah.
What are we going to make?
Exactly.
Awesome.
And it's also important, to mark, they did a very good job of identifying, it's like, hey, we're a sci-fi show. We've got some sci-fi actors that people who are the sci-fi nerds, they know who they are. And so, there are people who want to give to this. And so the more on brand you are, the easier it is to sell.
Awesome.
Yeah, because their fans all came along for the ride. Like, if you get an actor who is pretty well known but known for a different genre, that helps
sell.
You with cred, like with a film festival or something, I guess. But like, their fans might be like, "Oh, okay," but they're probably not going to give you money. It's yeah. It's about finding a good fit for the role and for the genre, and also this is actually really important. We told them all from the beginning we intended to crowdfund. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes, you know, sometimes if an actor doesn't know that it's going to be expected of them, there's a lot of pushback and resistance right. because it's a lot of work for them too. They have to post all the time on social media. They're yeah. they're putting their reputation on the line if
we
it
actually,
succeeds or doesn't.
We
so.
Had one actor who straight up said, "I'm pushing something else right now. I'm not going to be able to do this." Mm-hmm. And we said, "Well, can you post like once?" He was like, "Okay." And then that actor wound up posting
yeah, he actually ended
lots
up,
of times yeah. and yeah. was a huge, huge support system for us and really helped us get the show made.
But he wanted to be sure that we weren't expecting him to do all the heavy lifting.
Exactly.
He needed to know from us that we had a plan and we weren't going to leave him high and dry.
Yeah, good.
So that's really important.
That's really good advice. Do you guys have any other closing advice to aspiring filmmakers watching the show?
I would just say, I waited a long time for someone to like give me the money, you know, to do like something or just like hire me, like the more traditional sense. But like, if you've got an idea, go do it yourself. Don't wait for permission. I mean, be smart about it, but don't wait because it's a work by doing, like, you know,
yeah.
business. And so you can sit around like, you know, wanting, but at the end of the day, you want to go make something. So even if it's like even if you spend $500 and go make something, you never show it to anyone, you're going to learn something. You can get better and just keep doing that until
yes.
You've got something you're proud of.
Right. How about you, Dana?
Build your relationships mm-hmm. because
that's how this happened.
Well, that's how this yeah. happened. That's also how our writer's room came together. We literally just said to a few of our friends, "Hey, we want to see you every week. You want to write something together and maybe we'll make it sometime." We, you know, every person who we've worked with, we've built onto that relationship and we've made more things with them, and finding people whose skills complement your own, whose interests intersect with your own. It's really important. And you can't make anything by yourself. You can't.
Yeah.
Actually, to Dana's point, like our visual effects, our spaceship was made by one guy working for since the beginning
three
for
years,
three and
yeah.
a half years. And his name is Alex Moser, and the show simply would not have happened without him. And he's just someone that we met in college.
Yeah.
And we collaborated with on a few lower key projects. And
so your advice is to hire Alex?
Hire Alex Moser.
That would be helpful
so
too.
He's great. But
yes.
Like, the advice is make friends with people who could do things you can't.
Yeah.
Because making spaceships and making like creepy renders in video games, like that's what he does for fun. And so he did this for fun. Like, he has a day job. He pays his rent with something else, but I don't know anyone else who can make a ship.
Yeah.
Make sure though that you are also bringing some skills mm-hmm. to the table. You can't just come to the table with an idea and then have all of these talented people around you and then have them come to you and be like, "So what are you doing?" And you'd be like, so you need to spend that time developing your skills so that you're bringing something to the table too, so mm-hmm. that people want to work with you.
Yeah, and they can rally behind you, and then they can feel like they're not just serving your purpose.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're working on something together.
Yeah.
Great.
And that's to I guess my last thing segues pretty well from that. You know, my goal is to write. Pretty much everything else that I do, I see as a means to an end. I could probably count on one, maybe two hands, the number of people who have actually paid me for a piece of creative writing specifically. The one person I can always count on to think my writing is cool is myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one person I can always count on, yeah, she's, well, there's at least one thing I've written
Dana's
that you don't like.
Dana's giving the face
yeah.
right now.
There's
she's
at
like,
least one thing.
Excuse me?
And we can talk about it after. If you want your writing to get produced, then learn to do as many things as you possibly can. And you're only going to learn by doing it, which is why you shouldn't wait. Mm-hmm. And your first things are not going to be great, probably, and that's okay.
They're definitely not going to be great, and you should push past it.
Yeah. And
the
first thing
otherwise.
You release on the internet to people, people are going to be mean to you, and that's okay, too. It's really okay. Because you will learn how to produce, you will learn how to direct, You might even turn out to be good at these things, and it's okay if you don't want to do them forever, but knowing how to do them means that you always have someone who can do that work on your set, and you don't have to pay yourself.
Yes.
So that's a job that you just took out of the budget.
Right.
Learn by doing it.
Yeah, and that's something that I've done. Like, I've done a little bit of everything on all sorts of sets, but then when I get to work on bigger sets, when I am working with the people who specialize in lighting, specialize in, like, filming things, I at least can kind of speak their language.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, I understand your struggle. Like, I know that you're doing a lot. Thank you so much, because mm-hmm. I've tried this, and I know that you're a rock star.
Oh, that's so important as a director. Yeah. I think if a director doesn't understand what a department's job is, I'll use actors as an example because that's what I like the best as a director. But, like, if you just describe what you want from an individual in terms of the output, like, this is what I want to look like in the end, mm-hmm. or say this line like this, you don't, I think, get as good results as if you treat them like a collaborator and you say, do you think this process would produce this result? And then you have a conversation about it. And which you can only do if you actually understand some of what they're trying to do.
Right.
So you should try as many things as possible mm-hmm. if you want to make your own work.
Awesome. I think that's all really great advice. So thank you all for joining me and talking to me about personal space.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. Jeff, let us know where they can find you.
On the internet.
Well, he knows how to find everyone. I'm worried now. But yes, Jeff Hammer on Instagram.
On Instagram at El Jefe Martillo.
All right, Dana.
I'm on Twitter at The Fake Dana.
I'm on Twitter at Storytime.
Awesome. And then you can find Personal Space on Amazon. Make sure you watch it. You can find me all over the internet at Mary Lou Mandel. And we will catch you next time on The Fly Filmmaking.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
Views expressed herein are those of the hosts only, not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.